General Moore relates.
Where Martin Middlebrook's talking about, for instance, his view on what is likely to have been the motivation for things, I'm quite sure he's got it wrong. I acknowledge that human memory is an infinitely fallible instrument. Nevertheless, there are places where he ascribes various motives to me, and I have looked up the records since and have been able to check that I wasn't thinking that way at that time. So there is a certain amount of that inevitably, I suppose. But on the other hand, I would say that his books are pretty good on where he is sticking to what the facts were.
I'm intrigued by the meetings you had with the politicians in London before you left. Can you tell me something more about that?
Well, I, together with the Commander-in-Chief and as his land deputy and the prospective land forces commander, attended meetings from time to time, not frequently at all, but, for instance, briefings of the members of the War Cabinet, either collectively or in groups. There was one time when we briefed the Prime Minister on her own at Northwood. There was another time when we briefed the members of the War Cabinet at Northwood. There was another time when we did a briefing in Downing Street. And there was a time when the Commander-in-Chief and I attended a Chequers meeting over one weekend. And I think one was there probably, principally, so that they could feel they could get a grasp of what it was that we planned to do, so as to give them the feel that they understood the problems when they were making their political decisions as to whether we were to go ahead or not. What I admire, and I think does need to be understood, is that despite the marvellous capabilities of modern communication systems, we did not suffer from what the Americans pleased to call the president-to-foxhole communication phenomenon, because the president never attempted to speak to the foxhole, as it were. Indeed, I cannot but express great admiration for the self-restraint of my commander-in-chief, who, despite having a secure voice link to the South Atlantic, resisted the attempt to talk to me personally, daily or anything like that. And in fact, from my arrival in the islands to the end of the war, Commander-in-Chief and I spoke twice only. Once when he rang me, as you might say, after I'd sent him a signal expressing my intentions, to say, hang on a minute, I don't argue about your military reasoning for wanting to do what you want to do, but let me put to you the following, which I believe could be the political outcome of it if it goes wrong. And having explained that, he then said, I think you should think again. I believe he was right. I did think again, and we did things differently as a result of that. The second time was when I rang him after the Galahad incident, on the two grounds. One, that it seemed to me that it was my responsibility to report the bad news personally. And secondly, I wanted to tell him my view of the effect of it. And I've mentioned before that I, at the time, said I thought it was a four-day delay was going to be the outcome. And to discuss that delay with him. As I say, I have unbounded admiration for his self-restraint in not using that link more often.